This is the Medicast, March 24th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the MedicCast, episode 110. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the MedicCast, I want to welcome you personally to the MedicCast and urge you to head over to MedicCast.com. Check out all of the information. You'll find links to everything I talk about in the show notes there, as well as other articles, commentary, and items that I post up throughout the week. There's a whole bunch of information available over at MedicCast.com, as well as links to the other shows in the MedicCast network. And while I'm on that, I'd like to remind all of you that the MedicCast network is a proud member of the Blueberry podcast community over at BLUBRRY.com. You'll find players for the MedicCast, as well as other information on other great shows over at the Blueberry podcast community. It's been a good week here as I've been on spring break and getting into the last 7 weeks or so of my nursing program, and I've been studying hard and getting a lot of things done. But most importantly, I'm really looking forward to EMS Today, the expo coming up in Baltimore this coming weekend, and I'll have more to talk about on that later, but I'm hoping maybe I'll be able to get an opportunity to meet with some of the listeners of the show, as well as some of the other bloggers and EMS podcasters out there. And I'll have a little bit more on that in the link of the week later on. I think I've got something set up for that particular topic. Of course, remember, if you're a long-term listener, you are a part of this community and you have helped set up what is the MedicCast today by all of your questions, your comments, your suggestions. All of that's greatly appreciated, and especially your participation in the community directly, especially over at the MedicCast forums. So if you haven't checked out the MedicCast forums, I urge you to head over there and check it out for yourself. It's free to register. Join in the discussion of the community over there at forums.medicast.com, and you'll find all of that and more over at the MedicCast forums. Things that you don't get answers on from the show, you can bring up over at the forums and help each other out, as well as the opportunities that I'll have over there as well to contribute to the conversation. So check it out for yourself over at forums.medicast.com. Let's jump on into this week's listener mail. I got an email back from listener David. He got his t-shirt from the MedicCast Live. He was a listener in the recent episode on EMS education and sent in the secret code word he got during that live show. And I was able to help out and get David his t-shirt. So David, thank you very much for that. And I hope you enjoy having your own MedicCast t-shirt. And if you'd like to get your own MedicCast t-shirt, folks, you can head over to the MedicCast store at store.medicast.com and get your own MedicCast t-shirt or water bottle all over there. David, thanks for getting in touch with me, and stay in touch with the show and let me know if you have any suggestions, comments, or questions for the MedicCast. We'll get them on here and get them answered. I heard from listener Heath as well. Heath's always a great contributor to the show, keeps in touch with me with emails throughout the week on articles and things that he found. And Heath found some information on fentanyl, and specifically a type of fentanyl that he's been seeing more frequently on the street. It's a solid form of fentanyl that is put on a stick and dissolved slowly in the mouth and is used by cancer patients for pain management. So they use it like a lollipop and are able to get some pain management additionally in that route. It's very strong stuff. Fentanyl, very potent pain medication. We had some issues with it in our area last year when we had heroin in our community laced with fentanyl. These patients were having issues, especially because the Narcan they were requiring extremely large doses of naloxone, Narcan, to get them to get their respiratory drive back. And so we're something, this is something we need to be aware of and keep track of. And Heath, thank you very much again for sending that piece of information in. People, something to watch out for and just be aware of, that there are different formulations of medications and always new drugs and things popping up on the horizon. And something to keep track of and keep in mind when you're out there and run into a patient where things just don't seem like they're adding up, look for another answer. I also got an email back in from listener Chris. Chris Black's a good friend of the show. He's a longtime contributor to the blog and the podcast, and sometimes is able to free up some of his free time, which he has very little of, to join me on the Medicast Live as a contributing panelist there. And so Chris has been actually interviewing for some new job positions, and I've been interested in hearing his exploits. And he just got back recently from an interview for a flight transport job. And I don't have all the details, but I'm looking forward to hearing some of his response about that process, and that it was much more involved than he had expected, a very selective process. And I'm really excited to hear a little bit more about what he went through and maybe help prepare somebody else that has a similar aspiration to move into the aviation transport field. We can provide you with a little bit of expected outcome or what to expect in the interview. And hopefully I'll have some of that in a future episode. Chris and I were supposed to hook up and didn't. So I'm going to try to give him a call and see if we can get some more information on exactly what he went through in this process. So, Chris, thanks for contributing as always to the show. And again, good luck in your job hunt. I know that this is going to be an exciting time for you if some of these plans that you've set up come through. Time to jump on into this week's news. And I'll lead off with a cautionary story I got out of Florida. This is off of EMSresponder.com, but it has to do with a Florida family that is blaming the EMS providers that responded to their call for help for the death of their baby. The delay in transport of this child is what they're saying caused the baby's death. Now, first of all, I want to lead off by saying that I don't ever get into finger pointing in these particular cases of lawsuit and blame and everything else. What I try to do when I see a story like this, and I urge you to do the same thing, is to look at the facts as they're presented in the story, whether they're right or wrong, or one side's doing the right thing or not. I don't look at that. What I look at is the facts as they're presented. And I try to think about what I might have done differently, or what I would do in a situation that presented that way to prevent this type of thing from happening to me. And so I think that this is the way to approach these things. And so I want to make sure that everyone understands I'm not saying that anyone did anything wrong as far as the EMS providers in this situation. So what do we learn from this situation? Well, let's look at the facts as they are presented here. This has a mother and grandmother of a two-week-old baby who was previously admitted to the hospital for respiratory problems. Patients spent 3 days in a pediatric intensive care unit for those respiratory problems and then was cleared to go home. However, a few days after the discharge from the hospital, the mother and grandmother noticed similar symptoms returning, and the grandmother, who was a registered nurse, told her daughter to call 911. The baby seemed to be gray, the change in pallor, eyes had rolled back in his head, the baby was limp, and the paramedics arrived and they were asked to take the baby to the hospital. The crew arrived and disputed that claim that the baby didn't need help. And I'm not sure what happened, what the assessment was at the time. So this is where, you know, I kind of leave the story. I don't want to know who said they did what or didn't do what or whatever, okay? This is how the baby presented. The baby later died from respiratory failure. Family says that this is because of the delay in advanced treatment. Okay. So what do we do in this situation that you can do when you have a baby or a child of any type present? Well, first of all, you need to follow through and do those things that you do for every single patient. If you can treat every single patient and transport the same, be routine, be matter of fact in how you handle care, and do the same thing every time, you are going to do a lot to protect yourself from situations like this. It doesn't mean that you aren't going to have patients die. It doesn't mean that you aren't going to have adverse effects. And it doesn't protect you automatically from lawsuits. People can sue anybody for anything. It's up to the court to decide whether it has merit or not. So in this situation, what you can do, what you can learn from this particular situation is that, first of all, get a good history on the patient. Any patient that's been recently hospitalized in an intensive care unit for a problem and has a similar return of symptoms is going to be marked up in my book as a necessary transport. Any pediatric patient whose parent feels something is wrong is going to get marked up as a patient that has necessary transport needs. And this is because parents know their kids much better than I do. You have to trust the parents, no matter how many times you may have been to that house before, no matter how many times you've been and dealt with frequent flyers in a neighborhood, in a house, in a community, whatever, you still need to treat each call the same. And you still need to have that index of suspicion for any pediatric patient. And so, again, you just kind of have to protect yourself. And the best way to do that is to be methodical and uniform in your approach. And if you do that and treat every patient the same, you can go a long way towards making sure that patients get consistent care from you and make sure that should you have to come to defend your actions, you can go ahead and do so with confidence because you'll be able to say, this is the way I've done it every single time. This is the way I learned it. This is the way I do it. This is the standard procedure for my organization. And if you have that to back you up, it doesn't keep you from getting sued, but it may help you at the other end much better when the time comes to see whether you actually did anything wrong. So how many people out there are involved in the budgeting aspects of their organizations, whether it's a commercial ambulance service or a municipal or other government-run ambulance company? In fact, even volunteer companies, everyone is being affected by budget increases, by one particular area of budget increases to be specific, fuel costs. The cost of diesel fuel in most areas is up over $4 a gallon now. There doesn't seem to be any sign of relief on the horizon, and yet there's been no significant increase in the amount of reimbursement coming back to those organizations and companies. Something has to give. Can't pay us any less, right? I mean, there aren't enough of us to go around as it is, and we can't work any more hours if we have to, so I don't see that being a solution. There has to be something else come along. I found an article that talks about this very issue from the Connecticut Post at Connecticut Post Online, and they were talking about their local organizations, the local fire companies and ambulance services dealing with trying to save money on fuel costs. It's costing more and more every single day, and there just doesn't seem to be any relief in sight. There are some state-run agencies that are providing some relief for certain programs, but based on what I've seen in this article, it looks like that's just focused on Medicaid transports and Medicare transports. But for the rest of the agencies out there, they're going to have to just make do with what they have. The solution to this, of course, is to make sure that you're in contact with your local, your state, and your federal government representatives. That's what you put them there for, folks. And you need to let them know that if they want to have somebody show up when their house burns down or they have a car accident or their father has chest pains, they need to make sure that there's fuel in those vehicles. And at some point, some agencies are just not going to be able to pay for it anymore. Most places are already getting their fuel from municipal pumps. In our case, we get fuel at a discounted rate in many cases. as an agency that serves our community, even though we're separate from the government, we're able to use the county pumps and get some savings there, but it's still expensive. And so I would urge you to look into this in your agency and really get involved in your government at the community, state, and federal levels and find out what can be done to alleviate this problem, or our emergency response organizations aren't going to be able to respond quite so effectively anymore. So, drills, drills, drills. Anyone who's listened to this show for any length of time knows how much I like to talk about practicing and drills and staying on our toes for those rare occasions when we need to put some of these major disaster skills to work. And so I'm always interested when organizations in the states and around the world put together disaster drills of various types. I found a great article from the Michigan area looking at students in Lake County, Michigan, that were able to get together with local fire, EMS, police organizations, as well as the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, to put on a mass casualty hazmat drill. This particular incident revolved around a chemical explosion, either caused by a terrorist agency or organization or involved in other problems, and they were able to participate in this particular event in their gymnasium. And this was a great opportunity for these EMS and fire science students at the high school level to participate with their local agencies, as well as participate with military hazardous materials teams. And so this is what they did. They took the gymnasium, they had a chemical explosion in the gymnasium, and then they had victims from the Great Lakes Naval Training Station. 75 recruits came in and acted as the victims. Each of them had separate injuries filled out, and they knew what was wrong with them. There were serious injuries, minor injuries, and decontamination required for these patients. And this is just another incident of planning ahead. And I think Rick Rosati would say that this is always a good thing to do, prepare for those hazardous materials incidents. I don't think there's always going to be a need to make it a terrorist act, but you should be prepared for that eventuality, and you should be prepared for any kind of hazardous materials incident that might happen near or around your community. Do you have rail tracks that go through your district that might be carrying chemicals on some kind of train cars? If there were a derailment, what would you need to do to evacuate communities around those railroad tracks and deal with injuries? What would you need to do if there's a manufacturing or chemical explosion at a local industrial facility? All of these things can happen as well. So I urge you to read this article and maybe look at what you can do to set up something similar in your community. I'll wrap up the news this week with a story that comes to us from Kentucky. And in this particular story, the school officials there and the local EMS and fire officials are having a bit of a disagreement. It has to do with who is in charge of clearing students from injuries at a bus accident. This is something we've talked about a lot recently, and Rick Rosati actually did a great episode on dealing with school bus accidents and planning for school bus accidents at the Mitigation Journal about a month or so ago. But I don't remember him talking about this particular issue, although he may have. And Rick, if I didn't give you credit, well, I'm sorry. I'll have to go back and listen to that episode. But this particular article brings up an interesting conundrum. Who is responsible for clearing students that aren't injured in a bus accident? And this particular issue came up in the Louisville, Kentucky area, where a school bus was recently involved in a motor vehicle accident. There were 23 students on board. Two students complained of some injuries, but nine others said they were okay. Now, in the past, police and EMS have just gone through and let school officials know who does or doesn't need treatment. But in this case, they took a different tack and kind of upset the school officials when they told the bus driver and the school principal who showed up on the scene that they had to determine which kids needed transport or not. The school officials were reluctant to do that, And so students ended up being transported to the hospital because they couldn't sign their own refusals and be reviewed at the hospital, incurring additional cost to the school system and to the parents. And this is something that you need to check on. What does your local policy, your local protocol say about dealing with pediatric patients? What is the agreement with local school systems? This is something that should be known in advance because you don't want to run into a problem. I don't see any reason to transport kids from a school bus accident simply because they happened to be there if there were no injuries. This overloads the whole system. It ties up ambulance resources, it ties up the emergency department, and it causes needless expense and aggravation to the school, to the parents, and to the providers involved. So this is something that should be reviewed in advance and really followed up on in your agency so that you don't have this problem crop up after the fact you have prepared for it in advance. It's time for the tip and trick of the week, and I'm going to be looking at a bit of anatomy and physiology in a return to basics and look at the issue of hypertension. What causes hypertension? What kind of issues does it cause for the patient down the road and in the present? And what can we expect hypertension to do to other underlying problems that we might be dealing with in these patients? So let's look at blood pressure. What is blood pressure? Blood pressure is the systemic pressure against which the heart must pump to move blood around the body. It's essentially the amount of force it requires to force blood through the single-celled capillary beds in and around the body and allow blood to have enough residual pressure to return to the heart on the venous side of the system. Blood pressure can be influenced by a number of things. Let's look at the cardiovascular system briefly. There are three main parts to the cardiovascular system. There is the heart itself, the pump. There is the blood, the fluid that is pumped. And then there is the container, the vasculature, the vessels throughout the body from the arteries down to the arterioles, down to the capillaries, into the venules, and into the veins, and back into the heart. All of these form the container. Whenever there's an issue with any of these parts, you can have a problem with blood pressure, either too much blood pressure or too little blood pressure related directly to changes in any of these three parts. And it's really that simple. If you can trace any problem with a cardiovascular patient back to a problem with one or more of these particular systems. Blood pressure has two components, your systolic and your diastolic pressures. Your systolic pressure is the higher number. It's the first number you read when you come to a blood pressure. And the diastolic pressure is the lower number. And I always remember that because when something dies, it falls down. And that means that that's the lower blood pressure. That's how I learned which was which. Diastolic blood pressure is the heart resting blood pressure, whereas the systolic blood pressure is the pressure of the heart during its pump surge. And so this is the fluid moving through the blood as a pressure wave from that left ventricular contraction. When that ventricle relaxes, then you have your diastolic pressure. Technically, hypertension or high blood pressure is any blood pressure that is higher than 140 over 90. And I'm getting this from the National Institutes of Health blood pressure site, and there's a link to that in the show notes. There is, however, something called prehypertension, and this is when your normal average blood pressure is between systolic pressure is between 120 and 139, or between 80 and 89 for your diastolic pressure. This would be prehypertension. These are people that are going to be at risk for developing hypertension down the road as their risk factors increase. Then, of course, your normal blood pressure would be 120 over 80 or less. And I see those numbers dialing downward pretty steadily because of the issue of prehypertension causing many more problems later in life I wouldn't be surprised if prehypertension were to be dialed down into the teens or maybe even to 110 over 80. What causes high blood pressure? Well, again, let's go back to the three parts of the cardiovascular system. Remember, one of the three things or more has to have a problem to cause an issue with anything in the system. So if your heart rate is too high, if your contractility is increased, anything that causes the pump to work harder and push harder is going to cause an increased blood pressure. That's pretty obvious. What about the fluid? Well, anything that causes more fluid to be in the system is going to cause an increased blood pressure. This might be caused by an electrolyte balance, a shift in the fluid from the cellular and intracellular space into the vascular space. Anything that causes that shift can also cause a problem with the blood pressure and cause it to increase. And then, of course, we look at the container. Anything that causes the container to get smaller. Well, wait a minute. How does the container get smaller? Anything that causes the vasculature to become less flexible or less able to adapt to changes in volume is going to cause an increased pressure. So as you become older, your arteries walls become harder, they become less flexible. That's a risk factor you can't change. You're going to get older, everyone's going to get older, and everyone's blood pressure is going to gradually get higher. What about other risk factors? Well, if you exercise more, if you eat healthier foods, if you have less onset of atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, you can have things that contribute to your arteries being more flexible and better able to respond to changes in fluid volume. The other thing is anything that causes your system to cause those arteries or vessels to clamp down. So if you have a sympathetic response going on, you can have an onset of high blood pressure as your body's sympathetic response causes a clamping of peripheral blood vessels to shift fluid to the skeletal muscles and to the vital organs. You're going to see a shift in that respect as well. Anything that causes an onset of shock could cause that vasculature to clamp down and cause an increase in blood pressure in an effort to shift blood and maintain fluid volume to the vital organs. So those are the three things that can cause high blood pressure. There are two types of blood pressure problems as far as high blood pressure. There is primary and secondary hypertension. Primary hypertension is just blood pressure problems or high blood pressure that happens because of unknown causes. And it's primary hypertension because it's a problem within the system, and they haven't necessarily traced it back to a specific disease process. And some of these issues happen just as a result of age and aging. Some people are more prone to high blood pressure because of their family history. However, secondary blood pressure problems, like secondary hypertension, secondary meaning related to something else, and that secondary cause can be kidney disease, it can be a tumor or disease of the adrenal gland causing that increased sympathetic response, they can be congenital heart problems or congenital vascular problems that cause it, as well as pregnancy, use of birth control pills, addiction to alcohol, use of other illicit drugs, thyroid dysfunction are all cases that can cause an increase in high blood pressure. Oftentimes, people don't have an awareness that they have high blood pressure. They don't know about it. And it's important for anybody in the health field to be informative to people and say, hey, you know, what's your normal blood pressure? When you have a patient that you encounter in the field and you take their blood pressure and it seems high, you want to ask them, hey, what's your blood pressure normally? You know, people should know this answer. People should be able to remember their high blood pressure. And if they haven't gotten into the habit of doing that, you should tell them, you know, your blood pressure seems a little high and that might be normal for you, but it's important for you to follow up with your local primary care physician or talk to somebody at the emergency department about that, because this is a problem that can cause you problems later in life. And inform them about this. High blood pressure is a known cause for many problems that we see later in life. Untreated, it can be responsible for heart enlargement, heart failure, cardiac arrest, heart attack, stroke, and kidney failure, all happening because of untreated high blood pressure earlier in life. So it's important that people who have high blood pressure, and this is happening earlier and earlier, folks, you know, somebody in their early 30s or late 20s can have high blood pressure and present with that problem. And it's something that you can make them aware of in the field. You don't have to scare them about it. Just say, hey, you know, you should get this checked because it's not normal for you to have a high blood pressure, a blood pressure up in the 130s, 140s. That might be indicating you have a problem. You should follow up with your physician down the road. And this is, of course, for those priority three patients that have, you know, some other issue going on. And in the course of taking vital signs, you notice that their blood pressure is high. But it's something to keep in mind. There's more information that I'll be providing on the website over at the Medicast Extra. I do have a link in the show notes for this episode, and I'll have additional links available over at the Medicast Extra site for subscribers over there. If you're interested in checking them out, you can become a subscriber to the Medicast Extra. I always provide three or four extra links for the tips and meds in addition to the extra information available on the Medicast Extra. So how do we treat high blood pressure? We're going to look at one of those treatments this week as the med of the week. We're going to look at ACE inhibitors. We also have beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, but this week we'll look at ACE inhibitors specifically. ACE, A-C-E inhibitors, stands for angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors. And the angiotensin converting enzyme is part of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. This system is a system that retains fluid and constricts the blood vessels. Again, looking at those that three-part blood pressure system, the three-part cardiovascular system, we are acting on two parts of that system. We're going to hold on to more fluid. That's going to increase the volume of the fluid in the container. And we're going to make the container a little smaller by constricting the blood vessels. And that will cause blood pressure to go up. Well, if you want to slow down that process, you break down the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system that causes that to happen. And one of the ways that people do that, and one of the ways physicians do that, is giving patients an ACE inhibitor. ACE inhibitor stops that conversion process and slows down the constriction of the blood vessels in that system. Specifically, it goes in and stops the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, and by doing so, stops the constriction of the blood vessels because angiotensin 2 is not created, and that is the product that constricts the blood vessels. ACE inhibitors are pretty easy to recognize when you see them come across a medication list. In their generic form, they will often end in the letters P-R-I-L, Pril. So medications like Captopril, Enalapril, all of these meds are ACE inhibitors. And so when you have a patient that hasn't told you they have high blood pressure and you see that they're taking one of these meds that end in P-R-I-L, you're going to make sure you go ahead and ask them if they have high blood pressure. And I suspect most often the answer will be, oh yeah, I have high blood pressure too. So this helps you take a better history by understanding some of the meds that patients are taking. Sometimes patients will be taking this medication along with other hypertension medication. So they may be on an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker. They may be on an ACE inhibitor and a diuretic. Again, you need to look at all of these medications because patients may be experiencing hypotension related to taking too much of this medication or having to have their meds doses adjusted. And this happens over time. People either become more accustomed to medications or their body's chemistry changes such that they are more sensitive to their medications. So you need to look at the whole picture. And if you have a patient that seems to have their blood pressure bottoming out, it may be because of this or other medications that they have either taken too much or have a poorly adjusted dose at this time. Common side effects of using ACE inhibitors includes a dry cough, and this is commonly known as the ACE cough and is seen in many of the ACE inhibitors as a side effect. Also, patients may experience dizziness or weakness related to the onset of mild hypotension, especially if they've had high blood pressure for a long period of time. It will take their body time to adjust to having a lower than expected blood pressure. And they can also experience sometimes a mild rash related to having ACE inhibitors on board. However, they can have serious side effects and should be watched for things like an allergic reaction if they've just started taking ACE inhibitors, as well as signs that they may be experiencing liver failure or liver problems, signs of jaundice like yellowing of the skin or the whites of the eyes. They may also have lightheadedness or fainting spells related to having too low a blood pressure as a side effect of taking too high a dose. These can all happen, and people should be aware of this. If you see this happen in the field, you have a patient that's had a recent fainting spell, you want to be looking at the medications they're taking for their blood pressure. Are they on a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor? Or are they on a combination diuretic ACE inhibitor, as well as maybe taking a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker? So all of these things can cause issues and compound themselves when dealing with these problems. Patients who have this drug on board should be monitoring their blood pressure regularly and should be able to answer the question of what their average blood pressure is, what is their normal blood pressure range. And this is what you can use to get a sense of whether they're bottoming out or not. Also, be aware that patients who take medications like this, like beta blockers, like calcium channel blockers, are going to have an impaired sympathetic response. They're going to not be able to respond to situations where their body is developing shock. Anything that causes them problems, they're not going to be able to respond with an adequate blood pressure response if they need to shift that blood to portions of their body in need at times of emergency. So again, you need to be aware of that. These patients may be in distress, but they're presenting with what looks like a normal blood pressure. So ask them what their normal blood pressure is, and you may see signs of onset of shock related to this medication. Now, that's not as common in ACE inhibitors as it is in beta blockers. Beta blockers really just dial down everything, and you won't see an increased heart rate there. In situations where they are not taking beta blockers and just taking ACE inhibitors, you're more likely to see the heart rate increase, but you won't see the blood pressure reaction necessarily because of the ACE inhibitor effects. So that's going to wrap up this look at ACE inhibitors. And for Medicast Extra subscribers, I'm going to be doing an extra segment on the entire renin-angiotensin-aldosterone cycle for the Medicast Extra subscribers over at the Medicast Extra site at medicast.com/extra. Okay, that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and remind you all that you can find links to everything I've talked about over in the show notes for this episode at medicast.com/blog. You can also get there going to the medicast.com main page and clicking on the link for the Medicast blog. All of that information will be there, as well as links to other important things that I think might be relevant to this particular topic. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, you can do so by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also contact me using the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That is 941-30-MEDIC. Call in with your voicemail comment. Leave your email address at the very end so I can get back in touch with you if I need clarification. Don't worry, I'll trim it off so that it doesn't get included in the show. And maybe you'll get your comment played here live on the Medicast. I want to remind everybody to check in with the Medicast forums. If you haven't already registered at the Medicast forum community, you're missing out on some great discussions over there. I contribute occasionally, but I really rely on the rest of you to help each other out and answer questions. I keep up on what's going on over there and moderate the forums somewhat, but I really am interested in the community that is developing there. It's really been fantastic. You can contribute photographs, you can contribute videos, you can contribute questions and answers to the discussions over at the Medicast forums. And you can get there by going to forums.medicast.com. I also urge you to check out the Medicast newsletter. If you haven't already subscribed to the Medicast newsletter, the time to do so is now. You get all the links and the show notes delivered directly to your email inbox every week. So if you're listening to the show and you want to go back and check on something, it's all right there waiting for you, as well as a great way for me to keep in touch with you and let you know about special opportunities and deals that I send out to the Medicast listeners. And you can get extra information as well as be included automatically in future giveaways here at the Medicast, all by signing up for the Medicast newsletter. You can find links in the right-hand side of the blog and on the main page at medicast.com. I will close out, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music, and say that this is a song from Glenn Phillips. He's former lead singer of Toad the Wet Sprocket, and he's got a tune available over at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This song is a little bit of a rocker tune, something a little bit different from me. I haven't played too much rock recently, I don't think. So this is a song from Glenn Phillips. I hope you enjoy it. Check out his link in the show notes and let him know you heard his song here on the Medicast. Don't forget, for those of you that are heading down to the EMS Today conference this weekend, keep an eye out for me, and I hope to see some of you on Friday evening over at the DSX Sports Bar across the street at Pratt Street. I'll close out the show now and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I hope to see some of you this weekend, but until then, and until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Stop, it don't stop. You look down, can't comprehend such a long drive. 20,000 miles, I'm not a liar. I tell you, Steven Tyler's wishing he could have a piece of this ascending movable feast. A pay dirt, pay load, heave ho. Pack your Halliburton and let's go. We're free. Every mile high, we lose the weight of gravity. Climb the tether together, heading for the counterweight of the carbon nanotube spider web into space. You're gonna love it here. Get undressed in the mesosphere. Get so hot in the thermosphere. You know what's coming in the exosphere. To the top, to the top.